All right, I think we're live. Namaste and welcome to the Bharatvarta Weekly. We have a very special guest joining us on this weekly. We have Rajiv Mantri, who you've heard and seen on multiple episodes before. Rajiv is an investor and author joining us on this, on his first weekly, actually. Hi, Rajiv. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Roshan. Thank you for having me. Good to be back.
And of course, we have our regular Srivatsa as well. Hey, Vatsa. How has the week been?
Been pretty good. Hi, Rajiv.
Yeah. Hi, Vatsa.
So, yeah, we have plenty of news and events to cover this week. It was pretty action-packed, actually. Plenty of news from the world of politics, geopolitics, in fact, sports, and, you know, other related topics, right? So, so this week, we'll discuss the anniversary of the emergency, the COVID-19 Delta Plus variant, NATO's withdrawal from Afghanistan, New Zealand's win in the first World Test Championship final, Prime Minister Modi's visit to meet Kashmiri leaders, and of course, UP being a top-ranked state under the Smart Cities mission. Sorry. So before we get on with the news, we put out a couple of very interesting episodes last week, one on digital payments and the other in our continuing Long India series, where we spoke to Mr. Sridhar Venkat, who's the CEO of the Akshaya Patra Foundation. What do you think about the digital payments episode?
I think it was pretty good, right? I mean, we focused mainly on the report that was put out by Ritu and Smahi. And the report is pretty comprehensive. And it covers the evolution of digital payments and also talks about you know, some of the changes in terms of the laws that are going to take place, which will accelerate this trend towards digital even more. And we rounded off with discussing, you know, what are some of the other changes that are needed from a regulatory standpoint. And it was a deep dive and it was very comprehensive. So I would actually encourage everyone to go and listen to it if you're interested in, you know, fintech, digital payments and stuff like that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think very comprehensive, as you mentioned. And also, it was an absolute privilege and honor to talk to Mr. Sridhar Venkat, who's the CEO of the Akshaya Patra Foundation. I mean, the phenomenal scale at which they serve these meals, right? 1.8 million children every school day are served, right? And they've just got phenomenal process and technology supporting this scale as well, right? So Mr. Venkat put it very aptly, actually. He said, we have the heart of a nonprofit and the mind of a corporate, right? To explain, you know, how this works at scale and how they bring in those operational efficiencies. Again, an amazing episode. Do check it out for sure. So, all right, moving on to the first piece of news for this week. Earlier this week, we saw the 46th anniversary of the emergency. June 25th marked the anniversary of this significant period in Indian history. The Indira Gandhi-led Congress government imposed emergency from 1975 to 1977. It was, of course, one of the darkest periods for democracy in India. Prime Minister Modi on Friday tweeted that the dark days marked by the period can never be forgotten. He went on to say that this period witnessed a systematic destruction of institutions. The emergency was marked by massive amounts of state incarceration, stifling of dissent, and a general crackdown on civil liberties. Vatsa, this was a black day, a black period in Indian history, right? Could you just summarize, you know, what this actually meant?
Sure. I mean, to get into all the details will probably require an entire episode, but I'll just focus on the key points, right? As you mentioned, it was, you know, probably the darkest period in India's history in terms of how democracy was stifled and so on. The period leading to the emergency itself was not very good for Indira Gandhi. There were, you know, the economy was in shambles, inflation was very high. There were protests across the country, right? So pretty much the northern belt of India, and it started with Gujarat, where there was a student strike. The government there was run by the Congress, by Chimanbhai Patel, who was notoriously corrupt. And then Morarji Desai undertook a fast unto death, and that was when, you know, the assembly was dissolved. And this kind of galvanized the movement against Indira Gandhi across the country. You had the JP movement in Bihar, where again the assembly was not dismissed, but Indira Gandhi pretty much threw an open challenge to JP saying that, you know, if you want to come and fight the elections which were to be held in 1976. The JP movement itself has had a significant bearing on India's politics, right? You have a lot of leaders from Bihar who came from the JP movement, right? People like Nitish Kumar, Lalu Yadav, and so on. In addition to that, there was a railway strike which was called by George Fernandes, and that again kind of brought the entire nation to a standstill. So what was basically happening was all over the country, there was a movement against Indira Gandhi, and people within the Congress saw this as an opportunity to kind of get her out, right? And but she was very clear that she was the only one who could steer the party. To top it all, there was this case in the Allahabad High Court by Raj Narayan, which, you know, which is a very famous movement in India's electoral history, where you know, the High Court basically decided that Indira Gandhi had misused state power to win the elections. Now, with all this, there was a verdict that was passed that her election to the parliament was null and void. And it was, you know, in the backdrop of all of this that Indira Gandhi got the president, Fakhruddin Ali, to sign the proclamation of emergency. And when this happened, power was cut off to all the printing presses that were, you know, run by the newspapers. So you did not have newspapers for the next couple of days. And all you could do was hear Indira Gandhi saying why the emergency is a great thing on All India Radio. So, I mean, in every possible way, democracy was throttled. People's rights were trampled upon. In addition to that, there's this famous movement which was spearheaded by her son, Sanjay Gandhi, which was, you know, forced sterilization, right? Many people were forcibly sterilized. Many people died as a result of that. So overall, a very, very black period, you know, for India as a democracy. When we came out of it, thankfully, some of the laws that were passed, because you must remember that Indira Gandhi had a two-thirds majority then, and she could pretty much pass whatever law she wanted in the parliament. And some of those were kind of reversed when the Janata Party government came in, and some basic checks were put in place to make sure that something like this would not happen again. So all in all, I think when people, you know, nowadays talk about emergency and so on, they have little idea of how bad the situation was then. And the only thing the supporters of emergency can talk about is that trains ran on time.
Of course. Moving on. The United States and NATO have begun to formally withdraw their troops from Afghanistan. This marks the beginning of the end of what President Joe Biden called the Forever War. The US and NATO have had a presence in Afghanistan for the past two decades. The withdrawal comes amidst escalating violence against international forces and US soldiers. A deal signed last year between militants and former President Donald Trump, foreign forces were to have left Afghanistan by 1st May. However, the date has been pushed to 11th September, the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. Meanwhile, the US faces the logistical challenge of packing up and leaving. Reportedly, the military has been taking inventory, deciding what will be shipped back and what will be sold as junk on Afghanistan's markets. Rajiv, this is an epic change, right? I mean, so for 20 years, we've seen NATO and US in Afghanistan. What is the impact of their leaving right now?
Well, Roshan, so this conflict has defined the geopolitics of this region, the South Asian region, for the last 20 years, right? Since the 9/11 attacks. And for people like us in our generation, almost our entire sort of adult life has been punctuated by events connected with this larger conflict playing out in Afghanistan and Pakistan. Connected to the US terror, sort of anti-terror movement after 9/11. So it is really, I think, monumental sort of moment that is coming up in September. And the exit of the US actually poses a number of challenges in that, you know, the Taliban is actually making inroads again in Afghanistan, and it is making a comeback. So what that portends for Afghanistan's neighbors and the region remains to be seen.
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here. Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I was saying what the exit of the US portends for Afghanistan and its neighbors remains to be seen. I anticipate that it won't be actually a very stable situation, to put it mildly. So already we know that, you know, as per intelligence reports from the US, something like 8 million people are already living in Afghanistan under essentially territory that's in Taliban control. So, you know, that's about 20% of Afghanistan's population. It's already in Taliban control. Additionally, around 50 districts of Afghanistan are now in the control of Taliban. So what happens after the US leaves is, you know, likely is that, you know, the government in Kabul will collapse. That's what intelligence is saying, the US intelligence. So the ramifications of that, you know, Taliban making a comeback, I think sooner or later for us here in India, that too, you know, presents a major security challenge.
Right. Yeah. So moving on to the next news, the highly transmissible Delta Plus variation of COVID-19 has been detected in 10 states. Delta Plus is a sublineage of the Delta variant first detected in India, which has acquired the spike protein mutation called K417N. Reportedly, this mutation could make it more transmissible, is what they say. This mutation has also been linked with immune escape mechanisms and a potential reduction in monoclonal antibody response. In related news, the first confirmed case of the variant in Rajasthan was in a woman who had received both doses of the vaccine and recovered from the COVID-19 infection previously. What's that? This is a pretty alarming development, right? I mean, what do you suggest, like, in terms of preparations and so on?
Before we come to that, let me just talk about, you know, a little bit about the history, right? It seems like each variant is sort of adding on or acquiring more potency in addition to having acquired the potency from a previous version, right? And while this was first discovered in England first, it's a combination of, you know, the Delta variant that pretty much ravaged India in the second wave, and a mutation that was found in South Africa. While some of the experts are saying that it could be more transmissible, there is very little evidence to suggest that it is actually more transmissible. But having said that, the Delta variant itself, which caused a lot of problems in India, was not really that prevalent initially, right? And during the surge, it just kind of grew at an exponential rate. And the entire health system was ravaged by it. So it kind of makes sense that, you know, people are asking for more care to be taken, lest we see a repeat of the second wave. You know, majority of the cases that have been identified are in Maharashtra. That is probably because they do the most genome sequencing and they're home to the National Institute of Virology. So a lot of research when it comes to viruses takes place in Maharashtra and Pune, right? So the fear is that this can actually escape, you know, the immunity provided by vaccines. Now, again, at the moment, there's no evidence that the vaccines are less effective or ineffective against this. So considering all of this, I think it's kind of difficult to say at this stage whether this will cause a wave three or whether, you know, this will blow up. But having said that, there are only a few things that we can do, right, as a country, which is, one, we have had a stellar rate of vaccination in the last week. I think we've vaccinated upwards of 3 to 4 crores in the last 7 days.
Yeah.
Which is a phenomenal achievement, and we just have to continue, you know, at the same pace, get as many people vaccinated as possible. The second thing is obviously to wear a mask, maintain social distancing, and so on. But considering that this is a new variant and probably needs to be isolated, so that it doesn't blow up. What needs to be stepped up additionally is contact tracing. And that's again something the Maharashtra government is doing. You know, it's putting a lot of effort in doing contact tracing. It is trying to find out if these people who have this variant, they're vaccinated, where they've traveled, whom they've met. So the same thing will need to be done across states to make sure that this doesn't spread. At this moment, there's no magic bullet or medicine. So the way to go ahead is just continue to vaccinate and try to stay as safe as possible.
Yeah, I guess. Meanwhile, Uttar Pradesh has ranked as the best state under the Smart Cities mission. Madhya Pradesh was ranked second and Tamil Nadu third. Indore and Surat were jointly named the best cities by the Housing and Urban Affairs Ministry. The ministry said in a statement that 22% in terms of the total value of projects proposed and 52% in terms of the total number of projects proposed by the 100 smart cities have been completed so far. Under the Pradhan Mantri Awas Yojana Urban, the ministry said 1.12 crore houses have been sanctioned, of which 50 lakh had been completed. Rajiv, this seems like a pretty bold mission, even while we are under the grips of this pandemic, right?
Yeah, Roshan. So essentially, the Smart Cities mission is one of the three main urban transformation, urban infrastructure programs that the Union government runs under the Urban Affairs Ministry. So besides the Smart Cities mission, there is the Atal mission for urban transformation and the PM Awas Yojana for urban sector that you just mentioned. So what was announced recently is actually there was a ranking put out by the government saying which states and, you know, which cities and which states are making the most use and taking the maximum benefit out of this central scheme. And one of the cities which has consistently ranked high in this is Indore. So, you know, we often hear that, you know, what is the point of smart cities? What is a smart city? Simply understood, a smart city mission, the smart city mission is a program for urban transformation, where the central government has sanctioned certain funds for specific programs in waste management, the water sort of area, and other kinds of, you know, mobility, urban mobility requirements and, you know, traffic management. All those things are covered under smart cities. So what we are seeing from Uttar Pradesh is actually it is probably the best performing state now for the smart cities mission in the country. And that is so because I think there are five rounds that have been completed now. UP has put forward cities as candidates to receive some of these funds and implement the programs. It has disbursed funds both at the state level and benefited from central support also. And as a result of that, now it has the highest number of cities that are highly ranked by the Smart Cities Mission. So in fact, you know, there are states in India which are completely rejecting the central program. You know, they have decided that they don't want to participate at all. And as a result, they have zero cities from the states. And UP, of course, I think is setting the benchmark for the country by sort of fully participating and kind of working with the union government to frankly deliver something which is, you know, of grave importance, right, for economic growth.
Right, absolutely. And in fact, I think way back last year, we had covered some of the infrastructure development projects of Uttar Pradesh under the, you know, Yogiji government. So do definitely check that episode out. It's very comprehensive again. Right. All right. Some news from the world of politics. Prime Minister Modi met the leaders of Kashmir earlier this week in an attempt to chalk out the future political course of action in Jammu and Kashmir. Prime Minister Modi convened a meeting with attendance of 14 leaders, including four former chief ministers. This is the first meeting to take place since the abolition of or abrogation of Article 370 and splitting of the state into two union territories. The four former chief ministers of Jammu and Kashmir who attended the meeting are Farooq Abdullah, Ghulam Nabi Azad, Umar Abdullah and Mehbooba Mufti. So, Vatsa, you know, we did put out an episode sometime back on 1 year after 370, right? With Sunanda Vashisht and I forget the other person, I mean, but yeah.
Srimoy Taluktar.
Srimoy Taluktar, of course, right. And that was pretty comprehensive, and everyone was pretty optimistic for the future. What do you think this signifies?
So, I mean, this is, as you mentioned, the first time the Prime Minister has met all of them. But the interesting thing was the meeting was held without any agenda, nor were, you know, any conditions put forth by, you know, these 14 leaders, the two major parties from Jammu and Kashmir, the National Conference and the PDP. Previously, they were pretty, you know, fixated on the fact that 370 had to go before they start talking to the central government, right? But now I think there's a recognition that Article 370 having gone is fait accompli. It is not going to be reversed, at least not by, you know, till this particular ruling dispensation is in place, and possibly not by anyone else, because, you know, it could be political suicide across the country while it may pay some dividends in J&K. Now, and in fact, Umar Abdullah went to the extent of saying that there was no point talking to this government about it. And the steps that were laid out, you know, for all of these political parties from Kashmir were very clear. The first was that delimitation would be carried out first in Jammu and Kashmir for the assembly segments. You know, all of these parties, they were talking about wanting statehood first. But it was made clear to them that things will happen in a certain sequence. First, there would be delimitation, which and it also meant that the constitution of India as it applies should apply in Jammu and Kashmir fully, which includes, you know, things like SC, ST reservation and so on. So before any talk of all of these things have to be in place. And possibly the road ahead for statehood will be tied to the way the economy functions, right? There is a lot of conflict that these parties have benefited from, right, in Jammu and Kashmir and economically. So from that point of view, it's like a carrot and stick approach where they're being asked to move away from sort of encouraging conflict for personal ends to making sure that law and order is supreme in the state, in the first in the Union Territory, and then whenever it becomes a state, the state of Jammu and Kashmir. So I think these messages would have been sent very clearly to all of these parties. The other thing that I think would have been made clear to them is that, you know, Ladakh will continue to stay as a Union Territory, and there is no way it's ever going to be part of Jammu and Kashmir again. So I think a lot of credit also has to go to Manoj Sinha, who has been Lieutenant Governor of J&K, in the way he's handled the entire situation. He is probably the first politician to have been the Lieutenant Governor of J&K. And the way he has, you know, handled the local elections and, you know, made sure that there's a lot of focus on infrastructure development. There is, you know, some 12,000 crores worth of capital expenditure that's planned in the Union Territory, which is more than double of what it was, you know, the earlier. So from that point of view, Manoj Sinha has had a very critical role to play in bringing, you know, Jammu and Kashmir into the mainstream. And I think the parties have been given a clear message that they should also focus more on how to bring J&K mainstream by improving the economy, focusing on jobs, infrastructure, and so on. So, I mean, while we have to wait and watch what the final outcome is, but I think the messaging is very clear from the central government that de-escalate, move away from conflict, move away from, you know, encouraging militancy, and that's the path by which you will attain statehood, and not in any other way.
Right, absolutely. And finally, earlier this week, New Zealand won the first World Test Championship final. The championship was plagued with issues of bad weather, resulting in matches being pushed to the reserve day. The team beat out India in a nail-biting reserve day match at the Hampshire Bowl. They won by about 8 wickets after a chase of 139 from 53 overs. Kane Williamson and Ross Taylor built a match-winning partnership of 96 after Ashwin dismissed both openers post the tea break. This makes New Zealand the first team to win the World Test Championship, Mace. Rajiv, the sport was played in very good spirit, right? And I'm perhaps the only one who missed it.
No, such a great contest, Roshan. You know, this is the finest of cricket, and frankly, the best that you can watch at the highest level for any game. Actually, the kind of good spirited competition that we saw in this match was really something. And of course, you know, we all know how New Zealand sort of very narrowly, you know, almost in a very absurd sort of way, they had lost the Cricket World Cup, the One Day International Cricket World Cup, a couple of years ago. And, you know, there was obviously a lot of disappointment for both the team, as well as, you know, for, you know, they're such a nice team. They're reputed to be such a nice set of players that many fans were also quite heartbroken when they lost that match 2 years ago. So in a way, you know, one feels happy for New Zealand that they have finally won an ICC sort of trophy, an ICC tournament, which is very prestigious in obviously world cricket. India obviously played well, but, you know, somewhere they couldn't set a high enough target on the last day. So I think losing those wickets in the early session, that proved to be very costly.
Right. Just to add on to that, Roshan, I think you know, New Zealand and India have both been sort of, I mean, after the 2013 Champions Trophy, they've kind of struggled. India lost a Champions Trophy final to Pakistan. India lost a World T20 final as well, right, to, I think it was Sri Lanka. And New Zealand lost two 50-over World Cup finals. So it was almost as if, you know, someone's bad luck had to sort of come to an end. And, you know, New Zealand is a pretty small country, right? The population is probably half of that of Bangalore. And from there, and it, cricket is not even the major sport there, right? Rugby is. So from that to have, this is probably, according to me, the all-time best New Zealand test team, right? And it's at you all the time. They have five quick bowlers who are at you all the time. You know, perfect for conditions like the ones in England. In addition, I think India kind of missed a trick, you know, in terms of possibly playing one spinner too many. Although most of us wanted, you know, both Jadeja and Ashwin to play, no two doubts about it. Having said that, I think New Zealand also had the advantage. They were in England for a couple of tests, and so they were much more, you know, acclimatized to the conditions, and they outbowled England in England in the second test, which in itself is a fairly great thing, right? Not many teams managed to do that in England. So, well-deserved victory, I would say.
Yeah, and I mean, as I said, I hadn't watched a single ball of this match, but, you know, it was very heartening to see very positive messages on Twitter, you know, from everyone, Indian fans as well, right? No one really taking this as a very sour loss, and everyone kind of acknowledged that it was a hard-fought sort of a championship, right? So, yeah, fantastic news.
All right, no, these past few weeks have been a treat, right? For those who watch the sports. I mean, the French Open.
Yeah.
How amazing was that? Like the games in that sort of championship there.
Absolutely. I mean, absolutely. Cliched as it sounds, I think sports has won ultimately, right? So, yeah. And I can now join the Star Sports.
Join the Shastri team. Club.
You can become India coach. Is the winner.
You can become India coach now.
Let's move on from this fast as a tracer bullet. So, all right. On that positive note, we come to the end of a fascinating Bharat Vartha Weekly. Thank you so much again for all of your love and support. Please keep the comments and suggestions coming in. We have more interesting episodes coming up, and this is the 47th episode of the weekly, and you know, just to remind you, from the 51st weekly onwards, we will be premium subscriber only, and you know, a couple of different ways you can support us. You can join our YouTube community, just click join and pick whatever plan suits you, or you could also support us on Patreon. We're on Patreon at Bharat Vartha. So look forward to your support in the time to come as well. Again, thank you so much, Rajiv, for making the time. Really appreciate it. Thank you, WhatsApp, for being there as well. And stay safe.
Thanks.
Stay safe, everyone. Take care and hope you get the vaccine as well. And yeah, see you soon. Bye.
Bye.